You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host. And our topic today will be the top five threats to public land. Now, recently, we've had some actions on public land, if you've been keeping track of that. And if not, I understand that time is precious to all of us. But the five things that are threats to public land to me, first of all, is legislative actions. And that basically is things that happen where Congress tries to gut the acts that are protecting public land, such as the Antiquities Act. That's been sort of on the target of the Republican majority that's wanting to have more say over presidents setting aside national monuments. And, of course, using the Antiquities Act like President Trump did recently in reducing Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument is an example of misuse to me of the Antiquities Act. But there are proposals to try to prevent the president from setting any president from setting aside too much land, and that's one way to have legislative actions that take away from our public lands. Another way is weakening the 1973 Endangered Species Act, and that's on the radar of a lot of the radical Republicans, especially from Utah. Mr. Bishop, Representative Bishop, is one of those. And then recently, Trump opened up 9 million acres in six western states to oil and gas drilling, setting back really a sage-grouse protection plan that was a collaborative plan. And so that's a couple of ways that, you know, we can expect people against public lands to really try to set us back a space, especially that sage-grouse protection plan dramatically cuts back what the Obama administration had tried to steer energy development away from sage-grouse habitat. And, of course, you know, that's... In some cases here in Colorado, there was a nice collaborative plan that was put together that was working. So that's a shame. Another way is to have the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, they're a bill mill. In other words, they try to get bills put out that would basically privatize the public land in some cases. You know, it's... putting commercial interest over conservation, recreation, and other uses of public land as well. And then outright sale and disposal of public lands is something that we could expect to fight that sort of legislation. Or transferring public lands to be sold off, developed, or industrialized. And so repealing regulations, like I said, the Endangered Species Act would be one, gutting the Antiquities Act as well. But all you have to do is really go in and Google American Legislative Exchange Council, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about here as far as the dangers of to public land. So that's, to me, the first threat is legislative actions or inactions or executive orders that will try to marginalize those of us who really want to protect public land. Also, one way to do it is through not funding the agencies that are mandated to protect our public land. Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau, you know, it goes on and on. And that's one way I see that has happened over the years, slowly not funding these agencies enough to really have the staff to take care of the public land that's already set aside. And I've been joined here by my friend, Amy.
Hi. There we go. Thanks for inviting me, Bill.
Well, appreciate having you here. You can kind of spur my mind a little bit here on some of these issues. And the next one, I've already talked a little bit about legislative actions or inactions or executive orders that threaten our public land. But the next one is kind of controversial. I call it industrial tourism.
Industrial tourism. How do you define industrial tourism?
It's when... you all of a sudden see things at your favorite piece of public land happening that never happened before. Mm-hmm. You have herds of people. Some new technology comes along that all of a sudden assaults the places that you liked them just the way they mm-hmm. were. Mm-hmm. And of course, the overrunning of national parks by the hordes is one example in Utah, where I don't know if you saw the pictures last year, but there were a lot of places where cars are just lined up. There's no parking spaces.
Just like for Arches and Canyonlands? Right. Yeah. Arches Canyon has always been crowded.
Canyonlands, I mean, you've got to get in there. That's what I like about Canyonlands and the Maze. But but it's gotten worse. And just like Hanging Lake is another good example of that.
Very good example. And also, I can't remember exactly where, was it the Gunnison National Forest? This is an issue that's true for Conundrum as well, is the trash. The garbage that people leave there, human waste and all kinds of garbage that people just leave after they're finished camping. They don't pack it out. And I don't know if it's tons, but it's thousands of pounds, you know. I mean, it's a lot of garbage that comes out of these places. And I think that's what spurred, didn't that spur the Conundrum?
Right, yeah, Rangers
permits.
Having to go in there and clean up all of that stuff, and mm-hmm. I forgot exactly how many pounds of human waste they carried out, right.
Just disgusting.
It really is.
And people don't understand, some people don't understand the pack it in, pack it out, and, you know, leave no trace camping ethics. And that's,
right.
You know, and it also causes bare human interaction.
And another example is the continuing pressure from certain groups like the mountain bike community to want to keep on building more and more and more trails. And I know people in the mountain bike community. I worked with them when I was with the Forest Service. But I see that where one area gets opened up and everybody loves it for a while, and then they get tired of it. They want some more land. They want something mm-hmm. new. Mm-hmm. And that could fit into my definition as well.
Industrial tourism.
Right.
Well, yeah, and I wonder... I guess my question for you is, you know, for a while, trails seem to be this, sort of a light footprint, so to speak,
right.
This non-motorized recreation asset. And I wonder now if that's still true, because, you know, talking with public lands experts such as yourself and biologists, et cetera, are saying that trails are really fragmenting the landscape and they're not good for wildlife. What do you think about that? I mean, it's a controversial issue.
Well, it is, and I see a lot of trails when they're heavily used where they get wet and they come through a bog, and then people just use another trail that's drier and another trail. I even see that when I like to go four-wheeling back in flat tops mm-hmm. where you see just one more road, one more trail until you finally get a really...
The bandit trails.
Well, that's part of it, too. This is KDNK, and this is Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host. If you'd like to join us in this conversation, you can call in to 963-2976, and we'll put you on the air, and you can tell us what you feel.
That's right. Give us a call. Let us know what you think about trails.
I wanted to try that this time. Take a risk and just open it up for people to say what you want to say about what our topic is today. Aside from industrial tourism, actually, though, you know, I said earlier about the lack of funding, and it really has hit me because I have a friend who's putting a book out about the National Park Service. It's like an atlas, and I've been given the chance to look that over. And, you know, the Park Service has $9.5 billion backlog of maintenance, and half of that is transportation of roads, getting people into the parks and that sort of thing. And, again, this just seems to keep multiplying over and over when people don't think about, you know, what it takes to have deferred maintenance in national parks and forests as well.
What does that mean? I mean, if it's deferred maintenance, what happens?
Well, the buildings, a lot of them historic relic buildings historically on the National Register aren't treated, are taken care of or preserved, mm-hmm. and then pretty soon they just decay into the landscape.
Okay.
And a lot of the older, interesting conservation buildings that were put in by the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps.
In the 30s.
If they're not taken care of, they're going to be disappearing as well. And so, a lot of those are those deferred maintenance sites.
So would that be like Grand Canyon, Yosemite?
Right. It would be. A lot of those parks, Rocky Mountain National Park would be one of them as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's interesting.
I might miss a caller here or
I'll
two.
I'll let you know.
Okay, yeah, if you can watch for me.
I'll watch for the lights.
And then the third threat, as far as I'm concerned, is more frequent and catastrophic wildfires.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for sure that the sagegrass habitat is threatened by and replaced by cheatgrass whenever you have a massive fire come through in places like Nevada, mm-hmm. northern Colorado. And northern Colorado does have a lot of big fires. They had this last year as well. And the thing I'm thinking about that really, I think, hit home to all of us was the Paradise, California fire that wiped a whole town out.
Can I ask you a question about that? Since you're,
sure.
you know, you're a professional fire guy, firefighter, you know, that whole controversy about how our president said that it was because of poor management, and then there were some other comments from land managers there that said it had nothing to do with forest management. It had everything to do with the urban
wildland urban
interface.
Right.
What do you think of that?
Well, it's true. People have continued to move into places that we call the red zone here in Colorado, and millions of people over the last few years. And what happens, I lay a lot of it under the industry of insurance companies of not really requiring people to pay when you really build in a place like that that has no egress or ingress for forces.
What do you mean
in.
The insurance company doesn't, they won't?
Well, you just, they won't.
They won't cover it?
Won't cover it as much as they should. In other words, your premium should be a really high premium if you're going to build in an area like that, and it should require land use management. Incorporated counties and municipalities could also require that it be cleared a certain distance from their habitat and that sort of thing from where they're living. So there are a lot of things that could happen. There just doesn't seem to be a will to do it. And in Paradise's situation, of previous fire plans that are in place, when you have a catastrophe, really would help. For instance, the people escaping that didn't make it. If they'd been required to put a distance between the escape route and the forest and have that cleared a certain distance, it would make a lot easier for people to escape because a lot of people didn't in that fire.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see more of this sort of thing, not less.
Well, I was reading the climate report, this year's climate report, and one of the topics that is mentioned in terms of what do we do, sort of, is land management, land use management. And, you know, I guess that's one thing that we need to take a look at in terms of adapting to climate change,
is
what I'm talking about. What other land use management ideas should we be looking at?
Well, here on the White River National Forest, I was fortunate enough to be part of starting a group called the Future Forest Roundtable, which is a group of nonprofits, NGOs that gather every quarter and talk about how do we prepare for climate change on the forest. And one of those ways is to gain baseline data that you can say, well, this is the direction that we're headed. This is the measurements of soil. Of viability, of temperature, of all kinds of things you can measure. So you have a baseline, so when it starts to change, you know the rate of change.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one way to do it, is to try to get out ahead of such a thing.
So is there a baseline database for the data? White River National
Forest?
There is.
ACES out of Aspen has helped to do that. They're taking a lot of measurements and that sort of thing. A couple of other groups are helping with that. I can't think of their name right now. But that's one way to try to prepare locally for climate change.
What about ski areas?
Well, they've tried to diversify as a resort and not just be dependent upon the winter skiing and, you know, the downhill skiing folks and boarders. So they're trying economically to help out, and I know Aspen Ski Co. is, you know, has a position that helps with that, trying to get ahead of climate change. So it's just a matter, I think, of attention that and time that needs to be spent to this, and the ability for some people to put money out there and make it happen.
Well, I'd like to invite the listeners to give us a call here at 963-2976. Chime in, weigh in. It's
Don't be bashful.
Have you, I don't want to interrupt what you have planned here, so stop me if I am, but what do the what does the Ute Nation, what are they talking about in terms of, or what do they talk to you about in terms of climate change?
Well, it's not a lot of times on their radar because the situation on the reservations is enough to keep their attention focused on their own backyard. Mm-hmm. So it's not been a topic that I've really taken up with a lot of the Ute leaders simply because, it, like I say, they have more pressing issues surviving the world we live in, the dominant culture and that sort of thing. So that's a good question, though. I maybe need to start asking that question when I go about the reservations. And then the fourth thing really that's a threat to public lands and to us as a human being is water, the water issue, and also exotic or nuisance invasive species, because a lot of them are water species, such as the zebra mussels. So I think that's something that we don't tend to think about as far as what it takes to keep civilization in the arid West from collapsing, and I think that water situation is one example of that. And the Colorado River supports over 40 million people, and of course that's a lot of people. 16 million jobs, generates about $1.4 trillion in economic benefits, and then irrigates about 6 million acres of farmland. And the Bureau of Reclamation has projected a 50% shortage of the Colorado River in 2020.
Well, it's already over-allocated,
right,
is it not?
Right, absolutely, yeah.
So there's, which means there's the water that's, what is over-allocated? There's more water that's promised than exists.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you have the downstream users, Lake Mead and Las Vegas, and those people that there will come a time where that's just going to be cut off, basically. And you know, you don't want to cut off the water for Las Vegas, but those kind of things are pretty drastic and influence people and their behavior on the land. If you take the water away and water is threatened the use of it, then that's going to produce some water wars somewhere down the line.
Well, water wars, and I mean, we're speaking abstractly about that, but, and also, I mean, just looking at the economic impact of climate change in terms of, you know, the West drying up or lower snowpack, different times of the year that winter will be occurring. You know, I mean, what I've been reading lately is that skiing in at the higher elevations in the Rockies could go from like December and January. And that's it. Looks like you have a call.
Okay, let's see what we got on the phone here.
So I have phone.
This one.
No.
This one.
That one.
Here we go. Could you please identify yourself?
Hi, this is Fred Malow. Hi, Bill.
How you doing, Fred?
I'm doing well. While back, I heard that the effort by Trump to reduce Bears Ears and Grand Escalante was not legal because the Antiquities Act allows the president to declare a national monument, but it doesn't allow him to reduce one. There was a lawsuit filed on that, and I never heard what happened to that. Did you?
Fred, could you turn your radio down, please?
Sure.
Thanks.
No, that litigation is still happening, so we haven't heard what the results of that are, Fred. And I'm keeping my eyes and ears open on that for sure for the show later on when it happens.
Yeah, it sounds to me like they're on solid legal grounds there. The Antiquities Act doesn't give the president a right to reduce a monument.
Well, yeah, we'll see what happens in the courts on that one, because there has been some precedent for slight reductions in national monuments, one during the wartime. But, yeah, let's stay tuned with that, Fred, for sure.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we were discussing here the five threats to public
press
land.
Press that button. No, press that button.
And too many buttons here for me.
Thanks for calling. Thanks,
yeah,
Fred.
Yeah, appreciate that. Anybody else wants to call in, it's at 963-2976.
Yeah, we're talking about threats to public land.
Economic threats.
How climate change is the dominoes fall and the economy shifts. I'm not going to say collapses, because if we can adapt in a good way, it'll shift.
Right.
But it'll shift. We have to be, I think, willing to let that shift.
I think we all have to be. We have to be willing to change our lifestyles too. And
big
I don't
time.
Think most of us are willing to do that. And then the exotic species or the invasive species. If you've ever been to a wilderness area and it looks different, there's a lot of yellow flowers out there that don't look like they belong. That's probably yellow toad flax. And there is a lot of that stuff in the White River National Forest in the wilderness areas. And you hate to see those kind of invasive species get in our wilderness areas. And then, of course, you have, like I said earlier, the zebra mussels. You've got emerald ash borers, I understand, the northern pike that were introduced in 1950 and 1970 and have gotten out of hand. And if you catch one of those suckers, don't throw them back in.
Well, the emerald ash borer a couple of years ago was threatening the Front Range, has it? And it's a bug that eats trees.
Right, yeah. I don't think they've gotten a handle on it yet.
But is
sure.
it over on the West Slope? Has it been found on the West Slope?
I didn't do research enough to see if that's the case for
that's
us here
scary
on this
stuff.
Side of the mountain, for sure. And then, you know, the United States spends about $200 million a year trying to control invasive species. That's a lot of money we could be putting elsewhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
For sure.
But and what about the spruce beetles and the pine beetles? Well, have they sort of died out now that all the trees are gone?
Well, I think it's sort of hit a peak and it's on the downhill slide, but that's endemic anyway, but not nearly like the epidemic proportions here the last few years, decade, when it was discovered that the flights, they used to think there was just one flight of those suckers, and it turns out there's more than
one
flight.
They're like three.
Something like that, yeah.
Because it's not cold enough.
Right, exactly.
We need, what, a month below zero nights in order for it to...
Yeah, way below zero, And none of us would probably like that, but that's what it would take. And then the last thing to me, the last threat to our public lands are you and me. Because we're not taking enough action on climate change. Mm, we're not really taking enough action when we find these legislative actions happening, that we write our congressman or call them or light up their phone lines and really give them a piece of our mind. And so involvement, I think, for us, even in simple things like recycling, do we really know, do we really care enough to recycle like we should?
Well, and to learn leave no trace camping policies, camping rules, regulations, etiquette. That's the word I want.
Exactly.
You know, if you're going to go hiking, and a lot of people do, and especially those who are new to the area,
right?
You know, learn leave no trace. It's not camping anymore. Isn't about convenience and bringing stuff that makes it like your living room. You know, it's about learning how to treat the land and packing it out, what you pack in.
For
I'm
sure.
Lecturing.
If people would have done that, I don't think this permit thing would have happened as soon in Conundrum either.
No, so. I don't think so.
Well, if you have any ideas out there, we're going to take just a couple more minutes, 963-2976.
Yeah, we have about 2 minutes left.
That's about all we've got left here.
Right.
It's
and
getting dark outside.
It is. I love winter.
Here we go.
Just press the button.
There we go. Who do we have on the line?
This is Ramsey.
All right. What do you got to say for us?
Well, I like your program a lot, so thank you. I was thinking about the whole education and treading softly, like walking softly in our wilderness, right? And I grew up with my mom was a backpacker, and she took me on my first backpacks, and she always had that book, Walking Softly by John, I can't think of his last name right now, but, and, you know, she taught me what leave no trace is. And I just think, like, over the time, even, you know, like, even with companies like REI and these big outdoor recreation companies, there's a big boom in it, and there just hasn't been that follow through with education as much as probably been needed. You know, if we're going to go into the backcountry and go skiing, we go and take avalanche classes so that we're safe.
But we don't
make or highly recommend people be educated in their camping, and the wilderness has just really become more easily accessible.
Absolutely. I sure appreciate you calling in. Please do so in the future when we have these open lines like this. I sure appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
You bet. Take care. You've been listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. Until we meet again on January 8th at 4:30, whatever you do to Mother Nature, do it for land's sake.